When you look at news headlines, the people who tend to get the most attention in our society are people who do something wrong. This hour, we're going to recognize people for doing something right. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're celebrating acts of kindness. We'll hear about inspiring teachers, a professor that helped a young man turn his life around, a band teacher who provided much-needed friendship and support, and my seventh-grade English teacher who helped me love school again. We'll also hear about a life-saving babysitter, a man who makes toys for sick children, and some wonderful cats. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. An act of kindness can have a profound and beautiful effect on the life of another. This hour, we're celebrating acts of kindness. We've asked our listeners to share their stories about others who have touched their lives. In the hour, we'll hear about special teachers, a daycare provider who saved the lives of children in her care, a man who makes toys for sick children. We'll also hear about cats and others. My first guest today is John Paul Derryberry of Iowa City. He has lived through a lot. And as a young man, his life very nearly went off the rails. With the help of others, he learned to deal with his emotions, and now he helps others as a public speaker, trainer, and storyteller. He's also the author of Defending a Ghost. Hello, John.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming in today. And you grew up in a small town in Ohio, had a fairly happy, normal childhood. But when you were 14 years old, your family was struck with a tragedy. Can you tell me what happened?
Unfortunately, Dad was in a car accident during one of my baseball games. And due to the blood thinners he was on from some medical conditions, passed away from internal bleeding during the car accident.
How did that affect you as a 14-year-old?
You go through the normal range of emotions and people coming by and hugging you and not wanting to be hugged and then going to the funeral and then people telling you to kind of like, okay, it's time to get over it. And that's like a 2-week span. And that's not anything that I think most 14-year-olds or most normal human beings can do is get over a death like that. You end up questioning everything and then end up turning to anger because there's just so much going from this perfect little world to not having someone there for dinner, not having your dad to talk to you for advice on girls when you were finally getting interested in them. So everything changes, and most adults tell you, well, go do what you normally did. And I was really angry because I couldn't find normal again.
What was your relationship with your dad like?
It was kind of one of those father-son TV relationships that kind of make you puke when you watch the show. You're like, but things are too good. My dad got sick when I was younger, so he couldn't drive a car. And so he stayed home a lot. My mom did all the driving. And so, I mean, we did yard work together, buddied around together, watched wrestling together, played basketball together all the time, gave me advice. It was amazing.
After your dad died and you were trying to navigate the world, how do you think you were different?
I think that the added pressure of trying to figure out how to be a teenager and then trying to figure out how to be a teenager without the most important person. And so everything got shorter. You know, my patience got shorter. My temper got quicker. The moments of happiness got shorter. Thanksgiving was completely different. Christmas was completely different. Any moment where you could, you know, enjoy anything got really short because in the back of your head you were going, oh, Dad's not here. And my mom and I were trying to figure out how to grieve together and we couldn't. So we drifted apart and a lot of anger towards my mom because she was the one left.
When you were 17 years old, you experienced another serious loss. Can you tell me about that?
I had a friend, Eric Bunn. Eric and I both were born August 18th, 1982. We both were born in Warren Memorial Hospital. And turns out before both of our moms went in labor, they shared the room together. Eric and I kind of found this out when we were like 11 or 12 years old. And we started hanging out together all the time and calling each other twins. The joke is that Eric was African-American and I'm a Caucasian male, so people kind of looked at us funny. But we had a blast with it. And Eric's dad died as well, so I kind of had a partner in crime with going through this whole process. Unfortunately, Eric was in a car with a friend who was doing what a lot of 16-year-olds do when they get their driver's license. They drive too fast, and they couldn't make a turn on a road they were on. And I happened to be at the house on the road they were driving on and saw the car accident, and Eric wasn't wearing his seatbelt. And so, unfortunately, I was one of the last people to talk to Eric before he passed away on the life flight to the hospital.
Wow. So you actually witnessed this accident.
Yeah, I witnessed the accident and was the one of two kids that were on the scene talking to Eric and the driver and calling for help and everything. Yes.
What did that do to you?
That made me just never want to connect to anyone ever again, and really started kind of bottling up all my emotions and not letting anything spill out, and didn't want to reach out to anyone in life. It was the moment where the idea that death was better than life really was fascinating to me, that like I'm tired of feeling, so I shut my emotions off.
And you thought about killing yourself?
There was a night where my mom confronted me on some of the poor decisions I was making around underage drinking and kind of screaming and kind of yelling and doing some bad things in the home. And unfortunately, my mom and I got into it, and I was kind of abusing my mom. And that night, she had left the house. And that night, I spent most of the night contemplating whether or not to take my life or not.
You were a kid just at risk right then. I mean, you'd been through so much. Mm-hmm. You ended up going to college in Iowa. What drew you to Iowa from Ohio when you were at this point where you had so little?
Well, two things. One, I had a teacher by the name of Mr. Baker who came into a study hall that I had. And he sat down and he asked me, how are you doing? And I gave him the typical teenage answer because we had lost the basketball game that night. And I said, I'm not happy we lost the game. And I said, I don't care about basketball. How are you doing? And Mr. Baker was really the first adult to kind of sit down and tell me. And I remember him saying it specifically. I wouldn't want my son to be you. Losing your dad and losing a friend at 17. Like, I'm glad my son's not. And it finally hit, like, he wasn't telling me everything was going to be okay. He was telling me that it was okay to be angry at life. And we had a long conversation, and I told him a lot about some of the stuff that I had done. And, you know, he gave me some great advice that when I do my talks, I pass on was, here's John, you're 17 years old. Your story's not over yet. Feel free to change the ending. And I just think that's wonderful advice for anyone, whether you're 9, 17, 35, 72. You can always change the end of your story. And before my dad died, I promised him I'd play college basketball. And I got a scholarship to play small college basketball in Iowa. And it really felt like I was escaping to start new. And I know a lot of people tell you that sometimes you shouldn't run away from your problems, but I definitely needed a fresh start. And the fresh start came in Iowa.
Did you tell people what you'd been through?
Slowly and surely. And a lot more of it was a couple of my friends really drawing it out of me, and just, you know, late night conversations that everyone has in college and them sharing a little bit of what happened to them. And so I just kept talking about it as my friends kept asking questions, and kind of we helped each other heal from, you know, some of our childhood scars.
You had a professor in college,
yeah,
who really helped you tell your story. Tell me about him.
Yeah, Dr. Ken Jones. I was still struggling and kind of on the verge of getting kicked out of college for academic and not going to class and stuff. And I walked into his class 10 minutes late, and he goes, you know, John Derryberry? And I said, yeah. And he goes, good. You can be as late as you want. Sit in the front. I said, deal. And I kind of started taking more and more of his classes just because I liked the guy. And eventually he sat down and we had a conversation about everything. And he said, write me your story. Like, just the way you talk about it, write your story, and then I'll have you give a presentation. So the first time I ever gave the talk, I was sitting in a room, just me and Ken Jones. And I gave the talk, and he goes, excellent, I think this is great. I want you to show up here and give the talk at this date.
And by the talk, yeah, you said your story, talking
my story,
about your dad and
My dad and Eric dying and my family and how my family rebuilt our relationships and being in college and how I was trying to overcome all of this and leave that behind. But it was very therapeutic to go through that whole process and look from 14 to, 21, 22, where I was at when I started writing the story and talking about losing my dad and Eric and then meeting these people and my teacher.
What did he teach?
Philosophy and religion. The big thing with philosophy for him was like, John, life's great because there's no right or wrong answer. You can give whatever answer you want if you can make it sound good. And I kind of latched on to that. And so when I showed up to give it to an actual audience for the first time and really share my story and offer advice on how to overcome these things. It was kind of all the college professors that I had that had either I'd failed their class or stopped showing up and, you know, were probably upset because, you know, I wasn't taking school serious. And a lot of them said, like, we get it. Like, some of our students are here for different reasons. And I realized that moment, like, I had something. Like, I had a way to connect people and tell a story to get people to see how important emotions are in life.
So you communicated something very important to that audience, but that experience, that was a life-changing moment for you.
It was a completely life-changing moment. I didn't know what I was going to do after college. I knew I was progressing towards my degree. I didn't really have any direction or anything. And that moment was like, I can do this. Like, I can public speak and I can help people and I can give back and hopefully, you know, stop a kid or a couple kids from being me. And I was really never happy with any of the advice or any of the grieving process stuff that adults talked about around death and suicide and mental health. And so that moment I was like, well, I can be part of changing this and making it more normal to talk about these things and use humor and crack jokes about it and make it more real life than this thing that we set off to the side. It can be very isolating. So it really was a moment where I was like, this is what I'm going to do. And it was a great moment.
And you not only decided that's what you were going to do, but you're self-employed. I mean, you turned this into a career for yourself.
Yeah. Well, I still have a nice full-time job, but yes, I get talks all over Iowa and the Midwest, and I travel and reach new audiences every year, and it's grown every year since I've started doing it. And then in May, I'll be a keynote speaker at a mental health symposium in Sioux City, Iowa.
What does it do for you to tell this story to so many people and to help them understand that they need to deal with their emotions and it's okay?
I think the first couple years, it was the last piece of me healing. There's always a part of me that's going to be a hurt 14 and 17-year-old kid. And I had a friend tell me one time, like, I hope you never lose that part because that's what makes your story so fun because you're so energetic with it. The other piece for it that it does for me now is it just furthers this message of we need to share our emotions and emotions matter. And emotional health is such an important topic that sometimes we don't take as serious as we should. We don't take good care of ourselves. I joke in my talk, I ask people if they've ever been happy or sad and have their raise their hand. And most people don't really want to raise their hands. But when I ask the crowd if they've ever been angry, every hand goes up. And I'm like, yep, there we go. Humans, the only emotion we can show is anger. I'm angry. I'm angry. I can show it. And like, but we can't show people we're sad. We can't cry in front of people. We're embarrassed. Everybody has emotions. And why we're embarrassed about them and why we feel we shouldn't cry, or pushing that message forward and helping people realize that they got nothing to be ashamed of and life changes and emotions are great and that we should be sad when we lose people and we should be happy and frustrated and excited all in one. It's just so much fun to share that.
John, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
John Paul Derryberry is a public speaker, trainer, and storyteller. You can find out more about him at his website, jpderryberry.com. This hour, Stories of Kindness, will continue in a moment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're celebrating acts of kindness, and that made me want to share one of my own stories. When I was a little kid, I loved school. But when I was in fifth grade, my best friend at the time decided I wasn't popular enough to be her friend, so she started spreading stories about me. As a result, I was completely isolated socially in fifth and sixth grade. I started to hate going to school. Seventh grade was a new start for me in a lot of ways, and it was Mimi Ziske, my seventh grade English teacher at Pete Junior High in Cedar Falls, Iowa, who gave me a reason to love school again. And she inspired me in so many ways. About a week ago, I paid her a visit. We started out by reminiscing about my first day in her class in 1987. She assigned each one of us a famous person in history.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Pseudo-personalities, like right. They were called.
And I remember so clearly, I was Joan of Arc.
Oh, wonderful.
And I sat right next to King Tut.
Oh, did you?
Who was Alexa Smith, who is still a friend of mine to this day. So socially, things got off to a much better start even on the first day in your class for me. But I think the thing that struck me most, even on that first day in your class, was that I found someone who felt about books the same way that I felt about books. Mm-hmm. And I was always so amazed because I knew readers. I knew grown-ups mm-hmm. who were readers, but in my childhood, when I would read a book, I didn't want it to end. And so I would pretend the story and I would make up new stories and I would dress up like the characters. And here you were, a grown-up who did all the same things.
Yes, and got paid for it. Yes, my costumes. Yes. And that made all those experiences almost seem more real.
Absolutely. And you had your classroom decorated with costumes. You had mannequins up in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And you did a lot of different role-playing activities. Mm-hmm. So we started off with those characters at the beginning of the year, but then you decided that instead of diagramming sentences, we would diagnose sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And you gave us all characters. We were all doctors.
Oh, that
history.
Was a fantastic
yes.
unit. Yes.
And I was Ephraim McDowell.
Oh,
and I
yes.
was the doctor who performed the first successful abdominal surgery. I
yes.
removed a tumor from a woman who thought she was pregnant
yes.
for 11 months or something like
yes.
that.
Yes, yes.
So I remember it
oh,
all
yes.
so clearly. Did you have a role model in coming up with these different ways of teaching?
No, I didn't. But if you can attach learning to something really exciting, it's easier to learn. And that's was my theory, and I carried it out. And it was exciting to see all of you. The principal came in. I have to tell this story. The principal came in, and I said, would you introduce yourselves? And everybody stood up one by one and told who you were. And here were these magnificent personages from history. But what I remember, he said, I'm Dr. Ambrose Paré. I am responsible for ligation instead of cauterization on the battlefield. And he was right, and he used those words. And I was in partial shock. I'm sure it impressed the principal. Yes, but look at what happened. I mean, it was exciting.
It was exciting, and I remember it very clearly. Do you remember when you decided you were going to be a teacher and you decided that you were going to be this kind of teacher?
No, it just evolved, I guess. I was supposed to be a home ec teacher, but when I had to learn about the molecules in gravy, I decided it wasn't really for me, so I switched to English. And I have never been sorry. It's been wonderful.
I spent a lot of time with you, not just in seventh grade. Mm-hmm. You were my seventh grade English teacher, but we continued to spend time mm-hmm. together when I was in eighth and ninth grade. And I think the first time I came over to your house must have been toward the end of seventh grade because I had a project for the talented and gifted class mm-hmm. that I was doing called Images of Greatness. And in seventh grade, I was Louisa May Alcott. That was the person that I had chosen
okay.
to be. And so you helped dress me. Because
mm-hmm.
you have a remarkable collection of costumes.
And thank goodness, a big house.
Yes. And without you, I probably never would have worn a hoop skirt.
Yes. 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 Oh, that's wonderful.
And then you also helped me dress for a Victorian Christmas. I think I wore one of the bridesmaids' dresses from your mm-hmm. daughter's wedding. And I came over here for tea several different times. Mm-hmm. I was just astonished the first time I came to your house. And maybe you could describe it for us a little bit, because it's like a wonderland in here.
My grandmother had a house that I loved from the turn of the century, and I've tried to copy that. So I have, you know, Victorian or reproductions. The real thing is a little out of my income bracket. But and then reading books and learning about these things, which is fascinating. Yeah.
And all those costumes.
Yes.
You have had thousands of students over the
years.
I
haven't counted. I should do that. That should be fascinating.
You had a lot of kids come and go, and I'm sure you had wonderful friendships and wonderful mentor relationships with many of them. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm amazed that you remember so many of them, and I'm amazed that you remember me.
Oh, no, no, no. You're my child. I might have a lot of children, but you enter my life. I like to think it's a 9-month pregnancy, because that's how long school is. And so, yeah, you're my children.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being you and for all you did for me.
Thank you.
Mimi Ziske was my 7th grade English teacher at Pete Junior High in Cedar Falls. She retired in 2004 after 27 years of teaching. Now the story of another special teacher. Lindsay Moon is a producer at Illinois Public Media, but she grew up in Panora, Iowa, and that's where her story takes place. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for talking with me today, and we miss you very much around here.
Oh, I miss you guys, too. Thanks for talking with me. I miss Iowa. It's still home.
So you want to talk about your band instructor today, and he was your band instructor from 5th grade on?
Yes. Yep. So I met him as an eager 4th grade student who really wanted to be in band and had no idea what instrument I wanted to play. And still keep in touch with him now that I'm graduated from college.
When you were in band as a middle schooler, an elementary school student and a middle schooler, what did you think of Mr. Bush?
He is one of those teachers that has such an intense amount of personality. He's so much fun. And I think that that's the reason why I really grew to love band, is because he made lessons fun. He made me want to practice. And he was one of those people that it didn't necessarily matter if you were the most talented person in the group, but if he knew that you were really interested and you cared, he would invest the time to help you. That has just left a huge mark on my life ever since.
When you were in high school, you were going through a difficult time in your life. Can you tell me what was going on?
Sure. So I was into athletics and arts when I was a student. So I put a lot of time into playing basketball, and I blew out my knee, tore 3 ligaments, right before the last practice, before the first game of my senior year, and I was going to be a starter. And that was really difficult for me. Shortly after that happened, my dad went into the hospital with some medical and health issues. And so there were just a lot of things that were up in the air with my family. I was looking at a 7-month recovery for an injury as an 18-year-old. There were just so many things. I was also looking at going to college, and there was so much on my plate. It sounds whiny to look back on it now, thinking of other things that I could have been confronted with at that point, but for me, it was so much. And he was a rock in a big way for me. I probably spent 4 out of 5 days of my senior year of high school eating my lunch in the band room, just because he had said at one point, Lindsay, whenever you need to, just come into my office and, you know, make this your space. Need to go somewhere, you know, you're more than welcome to. And him being there for me in that way just means so much to me even today.
Did you see him playing this role for other students as well?
Yes. He is one of those teachers that leaves a lasting mark on every student. I have a twin sister. She was also part of the band. Her husband now was also in the band. And so we all have a favorite Mr. Bush story, and he just touched all of us.
But he seemed to understand how important he was in your life as well. You have a story about your final concert with him when you were in high school. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, so I played the tenor saxophone, and wasn't the most talented student that he had, but I put a lot of time into band and really loved going to contests. And I auditioned for Allstate. I never made it in, but to all of the contests that I went to, he wore this Santa tie. There was a Santa. He liked to go fishing, so there's a Santa hung upside down from a tree with a fishing line, and there's some reindeer looking on, like, what's going on? And he wore that to every contest I'd ever been to. The year that I auditioned for Allstate, he didn't wear this tie. My stand fell over in the middle of the audition, and I could not collect myself, and so I still blame it on the fact that he was not wearing his lucky tie in that audition as to why it didn't go well. But from then on out, he always had the tie on whenever there was a big contest or something. And so at my last concert, I was awarded the John Philip Sousa Award, which was like the Your Queen Bandy in my high school. And in the last concert, we did a tenor feature song with the jazz band. So I had this nice long solo, and he presented me with the award when we were done performing the song, and took a pair of scissors out of his pocket and said something really beautiful that made me cry at the time, and was just like, if Lindsay, if you're going to have success in the rest of your life, I just feel like it's been proven that you need this tie. And he cut it off right underneath where it was tied to his neck in front of all the parents of our high school band and handed it to me. I still have it. It's framed and hanging on my wall, and I've had it ever since.
That's a wonderful story. And do you still talk to Mr. Bush today?
I do. We're friends on Facebook, and I send him a new Santa tie every Christmas if I can find one. So I think since I graduated from high school, I've sent him one every year except for this one because I haven't mailed it yet.
Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lindsay Moon is a producer at Illinois Public Media. She was talking about her high school band teacher, Mr. Bush. Many of the stories people are sharing with us this hour are about the gifts of friendship and emotional support, or even about people who are just doing their jobs but touch us in that process. The next person we're going to talk about was just doing her job when things took a very frightening and serious turn. Tara Deckers is a daycare provider in Ireton, Iowa, in Sioux County. On the afternoon of December 6th, Deckers was driving a van with seven children, ages 1 through 6, in it, when the van caught on fire. Deckers was able to pull all of the children out of the van to safety before it was engulfed in flames. Ellie Pieper is the mother of two of those children, Carly and Jack. Hello, Ellie.
Hi.
Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So from all of the reports that you've got, what happened?
I got a phone call that afternoon, and it was just a voicemail saying that there was an incident and the van is not good, and then it was destroyed in the fire, but all the kids were safe, and that's all I really got in the voicemail. And so I called Tara and I talked to her for a few minutes, and she explained everything, what happened. And after I got off the phone with her, I just kind of was still in shock that my children were inside a van that was burning. And it still, when I think about it, it's just unbelievable how quick she acted, and you know, how God gave her the clarity and to use her best judgment to act fast, and without even really thinking, she just did it. And I'm very grateful for, you know, how she acted. And yes, I owe her my children's life, obviously, because they probably would not be here if it wasn't for her and how fast she acted.
When she told you the story, she said there was a popping sound.
She heard a pop, and then she looked back and saw smoke starting to fill the interior of the van. So she immediately pulled over and ran around to the side doors to get the children, and noticed flames underneath the tire. And right then she just knew she had to get these kids out, which all seven of them were in car seats.
Wow.
And she just told the three oldest ones, who were in the seatbelt type car seat, to unbuckle their seatbelts, get out and run into the ditch and just keep running as far as you can get. And by that time, then a passerby noticed, you know, some commotion and noticed the smoke. So he pulled over and started getting those kids into his pickup. I think the wind chill was like negative 20 that day, so it was very cold. And so he started putting the three older kids into his pickup. And as Tara was running in four other times to get each of these other kids out, which were in harness type car seats, I remember she told me the last time that she got the last kid out, her hands were shaking so bad and there was so much smoke, and the little child was coughing and she was coughing. And all she remembered is, I have to get this kid out. I cannot tell the parents that I couldn't get this kid out. I have to get it. And she did, and they all made it out safely and were sitting in this guy's truck until help arrived. And yeah, it's just gives me the shivers thinking about it still today.
Oh, absolutely. And Carly, your daughter, is 4 years old?
Yes.
So what did she tell you about what happened?
She has a pretty good memory of it. She told me about there was a pop and then there was smoke, and Tara had to quickly get them all out, and how she kind of just pulled them out and told them to run. And yeah, and I think some of the things she still remembers is what was lost, and the car seats were all burned, and some blankies, and that's, yeah, basically her memory. But, yeah, I don't think she really understands exactly how big of a deal it was.
Right. Well, and I've seen news reports, and Tara just says, you know, I just did what anybody would have done. But
yeah,
not anybody could have been able to do that. She really acted quickly.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I think some people, and probably including myself, if I, you know, heard a pop and I saw smoke, I don't think my first judgment would just be quickly pull over. I would think, well, I got to keep going. Like, what is going on? I need to get to town. Like, I need to go to a mechanic. You know, what is going on? And, you know, how fast she acted. I think if she would have waited two more minutes, then I don't think that all the kids would have made it out, because within 2 minutes, 3 minutes of getting the last child out, the entire thing was engulfed in flames.
Wow. Wow. How does this change drop off for you when you deliver your kids to Tara?
I've always liked Tara, and I've known her, you know, before I brought my kids to her, and she loves those children as if they were her own. You know, I can see that when I bring my kids there, you know, my kids just run up to her, and my little boy, Jack, loves her and loves her own children that are there, too, before they go to school in the morning.
Ellie, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Ellie Pieper of Ireton, Iowa. Her children, Carly and Jack, were rescued from a burning van by their daycare provider, Tara Deckers. We'll have more stories of individuals who have changed the lives of others coming up after our break, including a couple of four-legged individuals who've really made a difference. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're celebrating acts of kindness, but it's not always a human being that offers us kindness. Sybil Sukup is the executive director of the Humane Society of North Iowa, and she has been helped by the love of some feline friends. Sybil, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And I know that last year was a very difficult year for you, and I know that your year of loss really began with your cat. Can you tell me about Lucky?
Well, yes. Lucky was a funny old cat. And he was a constant companion for me for 18 years, which is a very long time for a kitty to live.
You lost him at a good old age after a good life, but you also then lost your dad.
Yes. At the time that my kitty was going through his illness, my father had a recurrence of his cancer. He had been a Vietnam veteran and had been diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma as a result of exposure to Agent Orange. And he had been fighting cancer for 12 years on and off. And it came back during that period where my cat died. When my dad's cancer came back, he had a little kitty cat in his care that he just knew that he wouldn't be able to care for anymore because of his health. And so she came to live with me, and her name was Angel.
And what happened to Angel?
Well, Angel stayed with me for several years. This last December, a year ago this month, my father passed away from cancer. He succumbed to his cancer. And his kitty Angel was an unbelievable comfort to me during that time because she was my connection to him. And the love that he showed for her, I showed her the same love. But this last August, one morning, she woke up and had a seizure. And when I took her to the veterinarian, they did an X-ray on her and discovered that she had a brain tumor. So I took her home. They were sending off the biopsy and getting results. But I took her home that evening, and she didn't survive. She ended up passing away in my arms. It was a devastating loss because it was another connection to my dad that I was letting go of.
After all of that, what did you feel?
Oh, just... I'm still a little teary-eyed now. emptiness. I mean, I'm still accepting the loss of my father, and to not have a cat there to comfort me was just deafening silence throughout my home, and it was horrible. There were many days where I'd come home and sit in my driveway and not want to go in the house because I knew there wouldn't be a little kitty cat to come and greet me at the door. So I waited about a month or so. And, you know, as you know, I'm the director of our Humane Society shelter here in Mason City. And there had been a cat in the shelter that I had grown to love and grew a bond with since he'd been in our care. So I decided to take him home.
And his name is Leo?
Yes, Leo. And he's a big orange kitty cat that came into our care after being abandoned by his previous owners. There was something about him, the way he looked, the way he would come up and rub his cheek up against my cheek. He didn't really care for most of the other people in the shelter. He and I had an immediate bond that was different from the way he interacted with the other staff.
So you adopted him and his best friend, Rico. How long have they been in your home?
Well, I brought them home in September. It was about a month after my dad's cat, Angel, had passed away.
And these guys, obviously you love them and they love you, but you also feel that they're particularly in tune with your feelings.
I do. I've felt a lot of personal loss in my life with the death of my dad and his long journey with cancer. I have a lot of friends and people in my life that have been there for me, but, you know, sometimes maybe you just want to cuddle with a cat and cry to a cat, and you don't need that interaction with the person. Maybe you just want to have a good ball. You know, it'll be a year this month that my dad has passed, yet I still mourn his loss. It was a tough death, and pets place no limitation on that grieving period, and they'll allow you to cry for as long and for as many days as you need to. Whenever I'm feeling sad or emotions come over me, it always seems like one of these boys comes running out from nowhere and jumps up to my lap.
Sybil, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Sybil Sukup is the executive director of the Humane Society of North Iowa. Kevin Drew has been going through some difficult times in his life, and his friends rallied to support him and his family in a surprising way. Kevin is the vocalist for the Des Moines band Marcato. He also works at Sonic Factory Recording Studio and teaches voice lessons at the Central Iowa Music Lab. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
It was a few months ago that you got some bad news about your dad. Can you tell me what happened?
I got a phone call in August and found out that the next morning my father was to have emergency brain surgery because they had found about a 2-inch tumor on the left side of his brain. This was a result of lung cancer, which had spread to his brain. So it was pretty scary news, and so I ended up going to Phoenix, Arizona, which is where he lives, and being there for the surgery.
And so he had been sick for a while, battling lung cancer?
He didn't know, actually. They had just found out about it on that Thursday, so it all happened very, very quickly.
Wow. So this was just out of the blue?
Pretty much, yes.
What did happen?
The surgery was successful. Actually, it went better than the doctors could have anticipated. The tumor was removed almost all in one piece, and so they were able to remove the tumor and then give my father radiation treatment to his brain. After several weeks, they started him on a kind of a home chemo medication regimen that is meant to target the lung cancer. And so now he's in a stable position, although, you know, not cancer-free.
And you ended up staying with him for about 2 months.
That's correct.
When you were down in Phoenix, you heard from a friend up in Des Moines, somebody who is a bartender at the House of Bricks in Des Moines. Tell me what happened.
Yeah, Ann Mathey is a terrific friend. She's a bartender at the House of Bricks, as you said. And she got a hold of me via Facebook, and she said, you know, hey, I heard about your dad. Everybody here at the bar is, you know, thinking about you, and we want to put on a benefit show to help raise some money, you know, for his medical bills and things like that. And I just thought that was wonderful.
What is your relationship with the House of Bricks, or was it because Anne is a friend? What prompted this action?
Well, my band has been playing shows at the House of Bricks for years. It's kind of a family atmosphere down at that bar.
How did your dad react when you told him?
You know, my dad's not big on attention, and so with everything happening so quickly, he was, you know, kind of like, oh, they don't have to do that for me, and you know, it was a little bit, he was taken aback by it, but ultimately I know that he was very appreciative.
So you weren't actually here for the show?
I was not here for the show.
So how did you participate?
We actually set up a Skype connection on one of the big screens at the bar. So so they had me Skyped, and my head was on a big screen, and so people could come over to the computer and say hi to me, and I was able to watch the show, and I was able to, you know, chat with a lot of friends from back home. So it was pretty neat.
In the end, what did that mean to you?
It meant a lot to me, you know. I mean, I guess it's times when things are going really bad in your life, when it becomes clear who your friends are and who really cares about you. And, you know, it was a great event, and it was a really nice opportunity kind of for me to see, you know, all the terrific people in my life.
What did it mean to your dad, do you think?
You know, I think it meant a lot to him that I have such good friends in Des Moines who would be willing to go through so much effort to try to help someone that they don't know. And I think to him that meant a lot.
How is your dad now?
He's stable. He's doing well, and he's in good spirits. And he's got a very good support system down in Arizona. We've got some family down there, and he's doing well.
That's good. That's good. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Kevin Drew is the vocalist for the Des Moines band Marcato. Our final story of the day is about an 83-year-old man who has touched many young lives. Lyle Barkley spends a lot of time in his garage workshop in Gowrie. He started out making toys for his kids and his grandkids, but his hobby grew, and in the past year, he made 2,500 wooden toys. He gave those toys to Blank Children's Hospital in Des Moines, where children who are in the hospital have a chance to play with and paint his creations. This tremendous act of kindness has touched the lives of Samantha Long of DeSoto and her family. Samantha's son Ike will turn 6 in February. He was diagnosed with a rare lung disease 5 years ago and spends at least 3 days a month at Blank Children's Hospital. Hello, Samantha.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Absolutely.
And you and Ike and the rest of your family, I'm sure you've been spending a lot of time at Blank Children's Hospital over the years. When did you first notice these wooden toys?
Oh, I would say probably 3 years ago when I got to the age where he was interested in painting.
And what kinds of activities are available to the kids with these toys? I mean, I know that they have paints, but tell me about what the kids do with them.
We do everything with them because he makes so many different types of wooden objects. He does anything from like a pull behind dog that has the legs that walk with you to kangaroos that have a little Joey in their pouch. He makes cars. We've done leaves, like when it was fall, he's made little leaves that we could paint. And recently we've done Christmas ornaments. He's also made like little boxes that kind of, we use them as jewelry boxes. They're very versatile because they're all based on the season. And when we've been inpatient, there's been times when we've had like races with them, with other children that are inpatient with the cars. And so they're very, luckily they're very time consuming. And so it helps pass the time for the kids, and they kind of forget that they're in the hospital and they're just playing. So it detaches us from the environment that we're in.
When did you find out where all these wooden toys were coming from?
You know, I would say probably in the last year I found out who made them. I honestly thought it was like Oriental Trading or somewhere that the hospital was buying them from. And then when we found out that it was a person locally making these, it was just so humbling to think of all the hours that he puts in. You know, when you were reading your introduction, it just gave me goosebumps to think about how many people were impacted by the 2,500 that he made just this year. It's a huge donation.
It is amazing. And Ike painted one to give away as a gift this year?
He did, yes. And in September, it's his grandpa's birthday, and we were actually inpatient on grandpa's birthday. So he made a car for Grandpa and painted it red and blue because those are Grandpa's favorite colors, and then gifted it to his grandpa. And so that was really special.
Have you ever gotten to meet Lyle Barkley?
No, I have not. Ike and I are in the process of collecting all of ours into one central location, and then we're going to take a picture of Ike with all of them that he's painted over the course of the last couple years and then send it to him as a thank you, just so that he realizes what an impact he's making specifically in our life.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So with Ike being in and out of the hospital so much over the last 5 years, and today we're talking to you, you're in Denver at the Ronald McDonald House right now, right?
Correct, yes.
And you go there to see a specialist?
Mm-hmm. Yep, one of Ike's lung doctors is out here at National Jewish Hospital, so we get to travel out here several times a year to do checkups on things that aren't easily managed in Des Moines.
With all of the time that you've spent in hospitals, I'm sure there are many wonderful people that you've encountered. Is there anybody in particular that you'd like to mention that has been really meaningful in your life and in Ike's life?
By far the most meaningful people for us are the child life specialists that interact with us every time we're in the hospital. They've become an extension of our family. One in particular is Kathy, and she is at the infusion center at Blank, and Ike just loves her. We walk in, and the first thing he asks is, "Where's Kathy?"
Oh.
And so she's become a very stable person for us, and not only for him, but for me. We went through some stuff, and I needed someone who has more experience on dealing with siblings with kids that have special needs, and so she was able to steer me in the right direction to get help for my daughter. And so it's not just playing with the kids. They really are a wealth of knowledge. And every hospital that we've been through, Denver, they have child life specialists, and they just really make everything easier. You know, whether it's trying to get an IV put in or accessing a port, they do everything they can to make it a fun environment and distract them from any pain that they're experiencing. I can't even imagine what going to the hospital would be like if there weren't child life specialists.
Ike has also had a wish come true thanks to the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Can you tell me what his wish was?
His wish was to go to Disney and meet the Ninja Turtles, which is kind of counteractive because the Ninja Turtles are a Nickelodeon. But they were able to send us to Florida to stay at the Make-A-Wish Village and arranged for us to be able to have breakfast with the Ninja Turtles, along with we were able to go to the Magic Kingdom. So.
Oh, wow. And how old is your daughter?
They are twins.
Oh, they're twins.
I have the twin sister.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
So that must have been incredibly special for both of them.
Oh, my gosh. It really is a magical place. You know, they always say that, but it truly is. It was wonderful for both of them because it is very taxing on our whole family, everything we go through to keep Ike as healthy as possible. And unfortunately, my daughter does get left out sometimes. And so the Make-A-Wish was a great reward for her also for everything that she goes through in helping take care of Ike.
How is Ike's health now?
It's okay. He had a bout of food poisoning the last 2 days, so we were out here in Denver for respiratory reasons, but then he came down with food poisoning, so we ended up getting admitted into the hospital for him to get healthy. So it's always a challenge.
Oh, wow. Well, Samantha, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Absolutely, and thank you for honoring these great people.
And happy holidays.
You too.
Samantha Long of DeSoto, Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Sarah Bowden, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Happy holidays.